If we think about Micah, he was called to be a prophet by God from his rustic home. And of course, he leaves these familiar surroundings that that he was in to deliver a stern message of judgment to the princes, leaders, and also to the people of Jerusalem and Samaria. We notice in the very first verse of the book, Jerusalem and Samaria, they're of course representative of the 10-tribe kingdom and the 2-tribe kingdom. It just mentions the capital. They're the capital of those nations. Burdened by the abusive treatment of the poor by the rich and the influential people, Micah turns his verbal rebukes upon any who would use their social or political power for personal gain. And of course, a lot of the people in Israel and Judah were doing that at this time. About a third of Micah's book expresses the sins of his countrymen. Pete was mentioning this before class starts, before some of you come in. About a third of his book exposes the sins of his countrymen. Another third pictures the punishment that God is about to dish out to them. And then the final third holds out the hope of restoration once God's discipline has been completed. Through it all, though, God's righteous demands upon his people is clear, as we see from verse 8 of the 6th chapter. And we learn there that his will for the people was to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with their God. The name Micaiah, which means who is like Jehovah, is shortened. Usually we just refer to it as Micah. And in chapter 7 and verse 18, Micah seems to hint at his own name there when he uses the phrase, who is a God like you? Of course, he wasn't referring to himself when he did that, but it just kind of reminds you of the meaning of his name. Micah prophesied during the reign of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, as mentioned in the very first verse. He was a young contemporary of Hosea, and he's called the Moreshethite since he came from Moresheth Gad. And Micah was unlike Isaiah. He wasn't a politician. He didn't censor the habit of looking to Egypt or Assyria for help. He denounces the depravity of the nation and threatens the vengeance of God upon God's people. Isaiah prophesied to the royalty. On the other hand, Micah ministered to the common people, the sort of people that would readily hear Jesus when he comes later. Isaiah was a courtier, you might say. He prophesied to those people in the court systems and so forth. And Micah was a rustic from an obscure town some 25 miles southwest of Jerusalem. And he was probably a yeoman, meaning that he was a small landowner. And he farmed his own little plot of land. And he was in sympathy with the class of people to which he belonged. The land hunger of the rich men was dangerous to the little country of Palestine, which had little foreign trade, and it relied mainly on the produce that was grown in the soil for the support of its citizens. The large landowners doomed to poverty a considerable part of the population, and so Micah stands out as a prophet or a preacher, we might say, to the poor and the oppressed. He regarded selfish luxury joined with the oppression of the poor as a crying sin of Judah. The people were heavily taxed, the Assyrians demanding large payments in tribute to satisfy their lavishness in their architectural magnificence. Thus, Zion was built up with blood, and Jerusalem was said to be built up with iniquity in chapter 3 and verse 10. Because of such exaction and idolatry, Micah was called and empowered to declare the judgment of God. That's it, mentioned in verse 8 of chapter 3. Michael was a man of strong conviction. He also has strong courage. And as a true preacher, he uncovered the sin and pointed to the coming of Christ. As a prophet, he went against the stream, and he uttered some truths that the people didn't really want to hear. Of course, Timothy writes about that as well. For this, he was consequently stoned, which was the usual lot of a lot of the prophets. And his cry in essence was first, back to Jerusalem in chapter 5 and verse 2. In other words, back to the messianic hope, back to David, who did so much for the nation, and to whom God promised that he would raise up the Messiah. Back to David, who was the constant ideal of the monarchy. And of course, the Messiah of Israel's coming golden age would be like David was during his day. Secondly, his cry was back to the ethical righteousness, as I mentioned in chapter 6 and verse 8. Micah, he brushed aside all the former ritual in favor of the righteousness given by God that had a heart for the need of other people. It was a righteousness based upon God's salvation. And another a cry that he seemed to make was back to the Prince of Peace, which is mentioned in chapter 4 and 5, the first few verses of each one of those chapters. We'll see if we get into those. Michael heralded the message that the reign of the Messiah was Israel's only hope of peace. And of course, we know that today, even that that's the only hope of world peace today. The messianic prediction formed the most significant part of the book of Micah. And to me, the most outstanding incident in which Micah's prophetic career was his preaching, which led to the Reformation under Hezekiah, as we can read about in Jeremiah chapter 26. When the king and the people saw God and repented, he turned from the fierceness of his anger. And of course, the Michael, being the humble prophet that he was of Philistia, he was chosen as God's messenger to the people, and the secret of his power was the fullness of the Holy Spirit that God had given him. That mentioned in verse 8 of chapter 3. The book of Micah seems to be characterized by deep spirituality with a simple but a not rugged style. Sin and corruption, the sighing and the agony of the people over the misrule of the men that were in authority, and insistence on return to God, these are all dealt with in no uncertain terms. Look at some of the terms that he uses in describing that. In the in chapter 1, verse 2, notice the sternness of his words in these passages we'll look at. He says there, "Hear, all you peoples, listen, O earth, and all that is in it. Let the Lord God be witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple." And then in chapter 3, in verse 1 also, he said there, "And I said, Hear now, O heads of Jacob, and you rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice?" And then in chapter 6, a couple of verses there, verses 1 and 2, he says there, "Hear now what the Lord says, Arise, plead your case before the mountains, and let the hills hear your voice. Hear, O you mountains, the Lord's complaint, and you strong foundations of the earth. For the Lord has a complaint against his people, and he will contend with Israel." The brother speaking, we might say the book is broken into three segments, as we mentioned already and Peter was talking about earlier. Chapters 1 through 3 has to do with God's judgment. Chapters 4 and 5 have to do with comfort, our coming blessings that people could look forward to. And then the last two chapters, we might say, has to do with salvation. Any comments from anyone concerning, by way of introduction to the book of Micah? We can talk a lot about the time of the writing and so forth, but I don't think those things are important. But I think with the time we have, we need to go ahead and get into the text and see what Michael really had to say to us. But we'll take the time if someone would like to comment about the book or anything about Michael in particular. Now let's go ahead into the text then. We've already noticed verse 1 and 2 already. Let's look at verse 2 again. Notice there in verse 2 that the Lord is in His holy temple. Where was God at when Isaiah first began his ministry? Isaiah 6 and chapter verse 1. He was in His temple also, wasn't he? Even when Isaiah started his ministry. But God is he's not going to be staying in His temple, though. He's coming down to the earth, and He's not coming for just a walk of joy on the earth, but what is He coming for?
Judgment.
He's bringing judgment upon the earth. Look at verse 3. Verse 3 says, "For behold, the Lord is coming out of His place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth." That doesn't necessarily just mean that He's going to walk on the top of the mountains. What is Micah having in mind when he's talking about these high places?
It's where the idols worship their idols.
Okay, it's where the idols were put, wasn't it? Remember when Jeroboam took over, he put idols from Bethel to Dan. He had them scattered all over, and usually they were put in these high places that it's referred to. And we'll see a little later on in our study more about that. But as we look on into that verse 4 now, shows us what the response of nature was to the Lord's coming. Verse 4 says, "The mountains will melt under Him, and the valleys will split like wax before the fire, like waters poured down a steep place." Of course, this is not literal language here. This is figurative language showing that the power that God had when he came. Then in verse 5, we see the cause for the manifestation of the Lord, why He came down to the earth. He said, "All this is for the transgression of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel." What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? So we can see then this is why God was coming, because of the sin of these two nations. It had left him and gone off into idolatry. The rest of this chapter pretty much has to do with the condemnation of the Lord. And verses 6 through 9, he'll be talking about the condemnation of Samaria. Look at verse 6 and part of verse 7. And we'll see there the result of God's condemnation. Verse 6 says, "Therefore I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the field, places for planting a vineyard. I will pour down her stones into the valley, and I will uncover her foundations. All her carved images shall be beaten to pieces." So you see what God has in mind for these disobedient people. When the Assyrians destroyed Israel and Samaria in 721 B.C., they actually took the stones of the city and threw them down into this valley that's mentioned there about the middle of verse 6. In verse 7 now, we see the reason for God's condemnation of Samaria there. It says, "And all her pay as a harlot shall be burned with the fire, and her idols I will lay desolate. For she gathered it from the pay of a harlot, and they shall return to the pay of a harlot." The Israelites had become so degenerate that so far that they had temple prostitutes, and I think Larry covered this pretty well when he was studying Hosea, the harlotry that was concerned there in that prophet's book. But when the soldiers would come into the city looting the city, they would use the money that they got from looting the city to pay these harlots with. And that seems to be what he's talking about here in that verse. And we look into verses 8 and 9, we see Michael's response. In verse 8, he responds in his mourning for Samaria. He says, therefore I will wail and howl. I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the jackals and a mourning like the ostriches. And then in verse 9, he is mourning there for Jerusalem. He says, therefore her wounds are incurable, for it has come to Judah. It has come to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem. Notice in verse 9 there, where it says, for her wounds, that's referring to Samaria, who he was just talking about there in verse 8. So the wound of Samaria then was the sin of Samaria, and it had come to Judah. And of course that wound or that sin was the Baal worship that they had brought to God's people, God's country of Judah. Okay, this brings us on down to verse 10. And from verse 10 on through the chapter here, we have Micah starting a series of puns, we might say, to explain what will happen to various cities. He takes the name of the city and then he uses another word which sounds like the city or is derived from the name of the city to describe the downfall and the judgment coming on that city. For example, in verse 10 there, he says, tell it not in Gath. Well, the phrase there, tell it not in Gath, was a saying that meant don't let my enemies know what's happened to us. They didn't want the word to get around of what was happening to them because they'd been disobedient to God. Then the last phrase in verse 10, he says, in Beth Arpha, roll yourself in dust. Actually, the meaning of the word Beth Arpha means a house of dust. And he's using that to make his point there. Roll yourself in dust. And of course, that was a showing the mourning process, or part of the mourning process that the people went through. He mentioned about 12 different cities here in Judah, but I don't think we'll have time to take each one of them and go through and talk about the name of each one and the meaning of that name and so forth. But when we get down to the last verse of chapter 1, we notice there the lamentation that he has. Verse 16 says, make yourself bald and cut off your hair because of your precious children. Enlarge your baldness like a needle. Why was that? For they shall go from you into captivity. So Micah is telling these people then that get ready, you're fixing to go into captivity. Okay, any comments from anyone on this first chapter?
I was just thinking about the similarity between this message and that of Isaiah during the same time that they were going to captivity. It was going to be many decades after this that it would take place, but it was going to take place, and they needed to be aware of it and take warning. Unfortunately, it seems that they didn't. In most cases, didn't take that warning.
Okay, exactly. Very, very similar. And of course, Isaiah, as I mentioned earlier, he talked to the people. The upper echelon, you might say, whereas Micah, he prophesied or preached to the lower class of people. Greg, you
know. Just if you think of the impact of Judah being there and seeing Israel going into captivity, the violence and the complete devastation, and you couple it with the message of the prophets, Isaiah and Micah at this time, then that would have a very graphic, pronounced impact on your thinking. I mean, the Lord making a very strong attempt to try to get them to straighten up here.
Okay. And you think that they would have learned something from Israel, wouldn't you? But what about us today? Look at our own country. It's gone through the same thing over and over again and still doesn't do the things it's right. Okay, Thomas, anyone else on that first chapter?
That's like that saying of those who do not learn from history are bound to repeat.
Right.
And that's what they were doing.
That's exactly what they're doing, going through the same old stuff over and over. Okay, as we look into the next two chapters now, chapter 2 and 3, we'll see some complaints that the Lord makes. chapter 2, we have one complaint there, and that's against the greedy people. And when we get into chapter 3, we'll notice about three different complaints mentioned there. And in chapter 3, the complaints were against the unjust rulers, against the false prophets, and against all the hierarchy in general. So let's look at the second chapter now, which will be God's complaint against these greedy people. And of course, these are His people that He's complaining against here. Of course, let's see. Look, verse 1 and 2 will kind of describe the greed or the of the people. Verse 1 says, "Woe to those who devise iniquity and work out evil on their beds. At morning light they practice it, because it is in the power of their hand. They covet fields and take them by violence, also houses, and seize them. So they oppress a man in his house, a man in his inheritance." These people were so involved in their greed that they couldn't even lay down at night and sleep. Notice what he says there in middle of verse 2, "and work out evil on their beds." Actually, a footnote in my Bible says to plan out evil. In other words, they go to bed at night and they lay there awake and think about what the evil things they could do the next day or within the near future of taking over a property that belonged to other people. Brad, can you comment?
I'm just thinking about these people. I think I've seen people like that. I guess all of us have. Just totally devoid of character. Everything, their greatest desire is that of having something that belongs to somebody else. And they'll take it not because it's right, not because they have any right to it, but because they have the power.
The power
they can do it, and if I can do it, I'll take it.
Aren't you glad we don't have that problem in our country today?
Right.
Such people like Mr. Madoff and lots of others. It's just a shame. I hate to even think about it, let alone talk about it.
I've made the statement, and I think been a victim of this to some degree, unfortunately not to the degree that these people were, but I'd rather be the one taken from than the one doing the taking.
Much better.
Final analysis, I think.
Much better off. Okay, well, God doesn't let these things go unnoticed. He didn't then, and He won't today either. But let's look in verses 3 through 5. And we'll see what's God's judgment concerning this. Verse 3 says, "Therefore thus says the Lord, behold, against this family I am devising disaster, from which you cannot remove your necks, nor shall you walk haughtily, for this is an evil time. In that day one shall take up a proverb against you and lament with a bitter lamentation, saying, we are utterly destroyed. He has changed the heritage of my people, how he has removed it from me. To a turncoat he has divided our fields. Therefore you will have no one to determine the boundaries by lot in the assembly of the Lord." So we can see then what God's judgment was going to be against these people, His people. Then in the next thought there, next paragraph, verses 6 through 11, which is a little lengthy reading, but we see the rejection of the truth because of the greed that these people had. And verse 6, he says, "Don't pride. You say to those who prophesy, so they shall not prophesy to you. They shall not return insult for insult. You who are named the house of Jacob, is the Spirit of God restricted? Are these His doings? Do not my words do good to him who walks uprightly? Lately my people have risen up as an enemy. He pull off the robe with the garment." Not only the robe, but even the underclothing is mentioned there by garment. "From those who trust you as they pass by." People that trusted them, they were actually ripping the clothing off them. "Like men returning from war." Of course, these were not soldiers returning, but that's just a comparison there. "The women of my people you cast out. From their pleasant houses, from their children, you have taken away my glory forever. Arise and depart." He says, "There's no place here for you." Remember, they're going into captivity now, and he's referring to that again here. "Arise and depart, for this is not your rest, because it is defiled. It shall destroy." Yes, with utter destruction. If a man should walk in a false spirit and speak the lie, saying, I will prophesy to you of wine and drink, even he would be a prater of this people. God's people are in a pretty bad condition at this time, but now in verses 12 and 13, we see that that third thing we talked about earlier, the promise of ultimate regathering and deliverance. Verse 12 says, I will surely assemble all of you, O Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep of the fold, like a flock in the midst of their pasture. They shall make a loud noise because of so many people. The one who breaks open will come up before them. They will break out, pass through the gate, and go out by it. Their king will pass before them with the Lord at their head. What's he talking about there in that verse 13 now? He's talking about being released from this captivity that they're not even in yet. Their king will pass before them. I think probably, if I understand this right, he's referring there probably to the king of Persia. Remember when Cyrus was instrumental in getting God's people released so that they could come back? That was the king of Persia that was passing before them. Of course, the Lord was at their head. He was the one who was actually going to be the one who would lead them out of that that captivity. Okay, comments man went on chapter 2. Okay, you're not very talkative. Okay, we'll go ahead into chapter 3 then, and of course this is the complaint against the greedy people that were mentioned earlier. And now in verses 1 through 4, we'll see the God's complaint against the unjust rulers. Verse 1 says, and I said, hear now, O heads of Jacob, and you rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice, you who hate good?